Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
November 25th, in Shmuel Beis, we are in Perek Chaf Gimel, chapter 23. We're up to Pasuk Ches, verse 8. Eileh Shmos HaGiborim Asher LeDavid. These are the names of the strong ones that were to David. So we're going to get a list here of David's primary soldiers. Most of them we have not heard of before. Some we have. Some we've heard of many times before. But most are going to be new names to us. There are going to be 37 names listed here. But as you'll see, it is not just a dry list, as we're going to get some significant acts of heroism that are going to distinguish these people. Also, the 37 people are not going to all be in the same category. As we'll see, there are different categories within these great soldiers. And as we're about to read in this very first pasuk, as we've talked about many times before, the great warriors in the day of David HaMelech were synonymous with being great Talmidei Chachamim. If one was a great Talmud Chacham, that did not necessarily mean they were a great warrior. But in order to be a great warrior, they had to be a great Talmud Chacham as well. It did not work. There was no Jewish great warrior that was not also an accomplished scholar. So the pasuk says, Yoshev Basheves, literally that means sitting in the sitting. Tach kemoni is some sort of a phrase that comes to the word chacham, which means wise or intelligent. Making me intelligent. It's hard to read that word, an exact translation of how you conjugate that word. Rosh hashalishi, the head of the soldiers. Now the word is going to be important for this rest of this perek. The word shalish means a leader or a soldier, a great soldier. Now the word shalosh means three. So we're going to have to discuss that connection between the two words. And here we're going to find groups of three or 30 used over and over again, and the word shalish, which means it's not just a soldier. It means
they translate it as captain.
Captain. Okay. So we're going to see those. The door. This. Yeah.
That's what we tried.
So that word shalish is going to be used many times. So we're going to deal with that connection.
Is this related at all to Shalit, where the final letter has been changed from a shin to a tough?
I don't believe so. To be sholeit means to rule, but that's with a tess.
Right.
We don't find a shin and a tess
ever interchanged.
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Now it seems clear that these words here, Yoshev Basheves Tachkemoni Rosh HaShalishi, is a reference to David himself. That's these are the names of the great the warriors of David, and now we're going to describe David for a moment. The one who was Yoshev Basheves, which means he was sitting in the Sanhedrin. As we know, David was the head of the Sanhedrin in his day, and he's also Tach Kemoni, which means he was a great Chacham, great, very wise person, and Rosh HaShalishi. Now, as I mentioned, the word shalish means captain or officer, and he's the head of the officers. He's the officer in chief of the armed forces. David HaMelech is he characterizes that far better than the modern day commander in chief of the armed forces. Not just today; I'm talking about in the United States in general, because today's version of the commander in chief of the armed forces is not someone on the front lines. But our commander-in-chief of the armed forces was always on the front lines. David always led the battles. He didn't sit back and send others into battle. He led the battles always. So he was the head literally the head of the armed forces. But Rashi here tells us that the word shalith should also be understood to mean three or thirds or three types of areas in which he excelled. He stood out as the top of everybody. Rashi says, Av benoi bechachma ubegvura. He was the Av, the father, which means he was the greatest. In noi, noi means beauty. Chachma means wisdom, and gvura means strength. So David brought together many talents. We've already known a great deal about his talent as a warrior. That is clear from all of Shmuel. We also know of his great talent in Chachma, in wisdom, as the great Talmud Chacham. But here we have another attribute that is given to him, which is Noi. Noi means literally beauty. It doesn't have to mean that he was a handsome person. It doesn't have to mean that. It could mean that he had a spiritual
countenance.
Yes, we do find in the Gemara that you have some sages who had a beauty the Gemara speaks about, but the Gemara is not talking about the type of beauty that we talk about today. The Gemara is talking about some sort of a spiritual glow, similar, of course, not in the same level at all, as what we know about Moshe Rabbeinu, that his face shone when he came down from Har Sinai. So no one is on the level of Moshe Rabbeinu. Even Yehoshua is nowhere near Moshe. As we know, Pnei Moshe Kepnei Chama, the face of Moshe is like the face of the moon. Pnei Yehoshua Kepnei Levana, while Yehoshua's face is like the face of Moshe's face is the face of the sun. Yehoshua's face is like the face of the moon, which is a great diminishing or diminishment, whatever the right word is, from Moshe. Nevertheless, even though no one can be on those levels, but we do believe that someone who is very, very spiritual, there will be some element of that glow that can be seen on a person. And it is discernible. I don't believe it's discernible today, but it is discernible in the time of the Gemara. You do have some examples like that. So David was the Av Benoi, as well as being the father in wisdom and in strength or prowess in war, also in Noi, in beauty, as I said, that could mean a spiritual beauty that affected his physical presence. Remember that when it came to physical presence, Sheol was the one who personified what you'd expect a king to look like. Mm-hmm. David didn't personify that. Nevertheless, he is called the Av Benoi, the father, the greatest in his personal appearance. Yeah.
It's sounding a little Kabbalistic to me, you know, that we've gone from Chokhmah to Malchus. You know, I wonder if there's some...
I'm sure there is.
Okay.
I'm sure there's depth over here. I'm sure there is.
I mean, Noi could be another word for Tiferes.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. I don't go down that road. I don't understand that.
It's just interesting.
Yeah, so many
of the spheros appear in Rashi's...
Yeah.
Explanation.
So David is so far we've described David. So we haven't even gotten to his soldiers, his warriors. Now it says, "Hu Adino Ha'etzani." He is Adino Ha'etzani. Now Adino Ha'etzani is somebody we have not heard of before, and the Gemara tells us, "Adino Ha'etzani." is actually two words that refer to the word Eden, which the word Eden is like comes from the word like to be curled up or to be flexible. Let's use that word, flexible. Etzani comes from the word eitz, which means tree, strong, firm, powerful. So the Gemara tells us that Adino Ha'etzani refers to a person who could be very, very flexible and also very, very rigid, very, very immovable and powerful. So in what way is Adino Ha'etzani both flexible and rigid? So the Gemara tells us that when he was studying Torah, then he was flexible, which means that a person cannot be successful in the study of Torah if he comes into it with an attitude that no one can cross me, whatever I say goes, and I know best. No one will be successful in Torah that way. Torah is like water, it flows to the lowest point. That's why it is no coincidence that Moshe Rabbeinu is the humblest, the anav mikol adam, because you can't be the greatest Torah scholar unless you are humble. The only way to acquire Torah properly is if a person is willing to say, I don't know everything, I need to learn from everybody, and together we can arrive at the truth. Because that's what we're after. We're after the truth. We're not after who's right and who's wrong. So that is while studying the Torah. However, when it came to going to war, this person, Adino Hatzani, was powerful and rigid and strong like a powerful tree, like the Eitz, which is immovable. And in that way, he was powerful and did not waver and was able to complete great battles. And the Navi gives us one example. Al shmona meos chola b'fam echad. That in one time, or echas, in one time, he was able to kill 800 people. 800 soldiers, enemy soldiers. In one battle, he killed 800 soldiers. Now you have to keep in mind, even though it is a little bit graphic, and I don't like to do this, but bear in mind that killing 800 people is far more difficult when you have a sword than when you have gunpowder. Mm-hmm. Gunpowder makes it less taxing. But this is all by hand. And he was able, in one battle, and a battle lasts for no longer than a day. It can't go longer than a day. They didn't have artificial light. So when the day is over, the battle's over. So a battle doesn't go longer than a day. So he was able to kill 800 of the enemy in one battle, which means in one day. That doesn't just speak of incredible talent or ability in war. It also speaks of great strength and endurance that he's able to fight like that.
But you have to remember that these people are trying to kill him at the same time.
Yes, yes. Oh, that's
still and let me kill.
Oh, that's for sure true. But people get tired, right?
Yeah.
You're 100% right. Now, who is Adino Haatzani? Who is he? So here we have two opinions. One opinion is it is David HaMelech himself. It is a continuation of the description of David. So we get the description of David in his being the great Talmud Chacham, etc. But we now get what we're really out to discuss in this particular this section of Shmuel Beis is the soldiers of David. So we begin with David himself. And who is the greatest soldier of them all? David. Of all the great soldiers he has, he's the greatest. So we get a description of David. There is another opinion that Adino Haetzani is Yoav ben Tzruya. And that opinion is bolstered by the fact that we do not find Yoav listed in these 37 names that we're going to see. And it is inconceivable that Yoav would not be listed, because although we have learned that Yoav did do some things that were not correct, but Yoav at the end of the day was a great tzaddik. Yoav at the end of the day died a tzaddik, and Yoav was the most powerful warrior of David. Yoav was his right-hand man. Yoav was his Sar Tzava. He was the general. So it would be shocking if Yoav were left out of the list. And so, therefore, there is an opinion that Adino Haetzani is Yoav himself. It seems to me that it is not coincidental that we have two opinions, one saying it was David and one saying it was Yoav, because it is probable in my mind that it refers to both of them. David and Yoav, remember, were uncle and nephew. David was Yoav's uncle. Yoav ben Tzruya. Tzruya is David's sister. The Gemara tells us that as far as relatives are concerned, the closest two relatives, other than siblings, meaning when you talk about blood relatives, when you get past siblings, the closest relative that a person has is his sister's child, as opposed to a brother's child. A sister's child, a brother and sister, that sister's child is the closest in terms of personality, in terms of family traits, all that. That connection is the strongest. I'm not talking, of course, of parent and child. I'm talking about siblings. When you get past those immediate relatives, the sister's child is the most powerful. The way this comes up, even though we would not recommend it today, is when the Gemara wants to describe the most likely shidduch to succeed, the most likely marriage to succeed, it is an uncle and a niece, which is a permissible marriage. It is not incest in the Torah. It's permissible an uncle and a niece. And the Gemara speaks of that as a very good relationship because it's the closest he can get to marrying his own sister. Because that would be the best, but of course that's prohibited. So his sister's daughter is therefore considered to be the best marriage that can be arranged. Today we don't recommend it because of the medical issues involved, but it is in the Gemara considered to be a very good match.
And that was Avram and Sarah, right?
That was Avram and Sarah, correct. That's right. And they're not the only ones. It goes throughout. You find that match being proposed, at least. So that David and Yoav would be described the same way is not surprising. And that in this list we would have a description of David's great strength and Yoav's great strength is also not surprising. Of course we should have them both listed over here since we're listing the great warriors of Klal Yisrael. And this first one that is able to kill 801 day is by far the greatest of them all. Yeah, your question?
Does this tie in what you just said about the relationship between the brother and the sister? Is this part of the look at a woman's brothers, you know, to see whether she's going to be?
Yes,
that's all part of like
that's part of it. Yeah. Yivdok ba'acheha. If you want to know about her, check out her brothers. That we know that from the fact that that Aaron married Elisheva Bas Aminadav. That was Aaron's wife. And then it says Achos Nachshon, the sister of Nachshon, Nachshon ben Aminadav. So why does it say the sister of Nachshon? So it's to teach us that if you want to know about the woman you're looking into marrying, look at her brothers. Now the reason for that is that presumably it's hard to get information about
the woman herself,
and it's easier to find information about her brothers, and this way you'll get accurate information. In today's day and age, when they discuss that particular chazal, many are quick to point out that is much more accurate in a day and age when people were in shtetls in the same community, and they didn't, you know, today when you can have siblings. Even, I'm saying, before they set up families of their own, who are far-flung, who are in different educational places, and they just, you know, have different experiences. So it doesn't necessarily have the same impact as it did in the time of Chazal and the time of the Chumash. But, yes, there is definitely a relationship there that is worth checking into. Yeah.
Is the number 37 significant?
Is the number 37 significant? It's a good question. We're going to see that really it's 30 plus 7. So I don't know if the total number is significant. That's a good question, though. I don't know. So he's the first. Now, the second one, we have not heard of before. L'acharav, Elazar ben Dodi ben Achochi. So, this is a person, Elazar ben Dodi ben Achochi. And what about him? Bishlosha hagiborim im David. He was with the three warriors with David. As we're about to see, of these, this list we're going to have, the first three formed a group of three. There was a group of three that were the top of these warriors. Adino Ha'atzani, we'll presume that's Yoav. Now we have Elazar ben Dodi, who is the second one, who forms the second of these three primary warriors who were with David. What happened with him? Becharfam baplishtim, when they... L'charef means to put down or to denigrate. They became on the bad side of the Plishtim. The Plishtim got angry at them at some point. We're going to see references here to many fights with the Plishtim that we can't necessarily go back in Shmuel and find where these exact battles took place. Many of the Mefarshim try to link each of these battles with known battles, but it could be that the battle that we're referring to here was not recorded before. So they were with David. Nes v'shama melchama, they gathered there for war. The Plishtim gathered for war. Vayalu ish Yisrael, the Jewish people, the men, the soldiers of the Jews, were ole, they went up. It means they left. They were scared. The Plishtim amassed against the Jews, and the Jewish army got scared and they began to scatter. What did Elazar ben Dodi ben Achochi do? Who come, he got up, Vayach ba Plishtim, and he struck against the Plishtim, Ad ki yaga yado, until his hand became tired, as I was trying to describe to you before. Vatidbak yado el acherev, his hand became attached to the sword. He's wielding that sword, and I saw the Malbim describes, like, you know, sometimes you get you're so involved with it. He said you have trouble opening your fingers. That's what's happened over here. He became so attached to the sword he couldn't undo his fingers. Vayas Hashem Teshua Gedola Bayomahu, Hashem did a great salvation on that day. V'ha'am yashvu acharav achlef hasheit. The nation came back after Elazar ben Dodi ben Achochi just to take the spoils from the corpses. Meaning, they didn't even help him fight. They just followed in his wake, despoiling the enemy. But they were already dead. He had already killed them all. So that's the second one. Elazar ben Dodi ben Achochi, in this particular battle, he saved the day on his own.
You know, why do we interpret the Ya'alu as they fled or they left? I mean, it means that they went up. So they could have gone up against the Plishtim.
They could have.
I mean, if they fled or left, it could have said that. It said fled or left.
We do have the phrase Alu before, where it means to go up from battle, to be Yoreh, to go down to battle.
Down to battle, it sounds to me, would be to engage in it.
Right. Right, and Allah, most of the time the battles took place
in a plane.
Right, so it would be very disadvantageous to have a battle where you're going up a mountain. The ones on top are always in a much greater position. So the battles generally took place on a flat surface somewhere, which is usually
means they went up into the hills and they something fled like that. From the plane.
It doesn't have to mean that they ran. But they
retreated.
Right, they retreated.
Up into
that's a better translation. Right. Okay. They're right. They were backing off. They weren't ready to engage the enemy. Right.
If we were reading these stories today, we would say that somebody exaggerated their writing. But we know that there's not exaggeration here. But it's still
unbelievable. It sounds unbelievable. I agree with you. Very hard to believe. You know, it's not impossible for the Navi to exaggerate, but here we know that it's accurate because the whole point that Navi's trying to do over here is describe to us what happened. Here an exaggeration would mislead us. And the goal over here is to have us understand how powerful these people were.
When you're in battle, you're surrounded by enemies, so it seems unbelievable that nobody...
Got them from the back.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could be surrounded. It depends
when there's 800 of them, you're going to be surrounded.
Yeah, it could be. I got you. I'm just as, you know, as amazed by this. Part of it is also because our way of doing battle because of gunpowder has completely changed from what it used to be. So it's very hard to picture it. When I see paintings or you know, some sort of depiction of hand-to-hand combat, you know, with swords and horses and all that, and you see like this whole conflagration, you know, it's hard to understand how anybody can feel that they're in control of what's going on. Because anybody can be all around you. Someone can be on top of you, underneath you. There's no
chaotic.
It's very chaotic. So I don't understand it. But in the art of war, there is some sort of strategy. So I just don't know what it is.
But you would think their strategy, if there's only one guy, would be the Russian.
You would think.
Guy could have had, for example, just to give an example, the guy could have been backed up against a rock. And people could have had only one way of approaching him, and his weapon might have been a lot better, and his health and strength might have been
just sheer numbers. You have eight people coming towards you. Your sword
you
can only hit one sword at a time.
And you're back. I'm just saying there are ways, you know, that it could actually work out. I think
it could be. It could be. They
800?
Could also. It could be also in that situation. You know, why would they? Why wouldn't they back off? Let him come to them. You know, it's hard to understand. I agree. It's hard to understand
because the sword gets dull.
Yeah.
They have to constantly sharpen their swords in order to be effective.
So after you're
getting rid of 800, I would think you'd have a very dull sword.
Now you notice that in the pasuk we just read, it says Vayas Hashem Teshua Gedola Bayomahu. Hashem did a great salvation, which means what we're not saying that these people
were natural.
I mean, they did have natural ability, but these numbers are so high that there has to be something supernatural going on. It could be the sword staying sharp was a supernatural thing. That could be.
It also comes if there was hundreds of others running. I mean, they killed 800 out of how many?
Right. Okay, that's true. We don't know that either.
It's interesting. In Chronicles, it says 300.
Yes. So that the Mefarshim asked that question, between the 300 and the 800. The question is it two different battles? Which is possible.
That's possible.
Is it two different battles? Or is it that it was the same battle, but 300 were particularly strong? You know, it was the heart. It was 300 really powerful warriors that he defeated, and then 500 other ones. Right. Yud Aleph, verse 11. Who is the third of the three? V'acharav Shama ben Agei Harari. That's his name. Shama ben Agei from the mountain. And what did he do? Vayeyasu plishtim lachaya, and the plishtim gathered lachaya. Now, achaya is an animal. They gathered like the beasts of the field. Vatihi sham chelkas hasada malei adashim, and there the portion of the field was filled with lentils. V'ha'am nas mipnei plishtim, and here it says the nation ran away from the plishtim. The plishtim were massed against them, and they ran away.
Yeah.
So Shama ben Agei Harari stood in that portion, and he saved it. And he struck the plishtim. It does not say how many he killed, but he saved the portion, that area they wanted to take over. So these are the first three of the great warriors of David.
Why mention lentils?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So we're going to get to that in a moment. Good. I don't know why specifically lentils, but we need to know there's food there, as we'll see in a moment. So, the plishtim wanted to take the food or burn the food. One or the other. In other words, they wanted to either take the food for themselves or they wanted to hurt us by hurting our crops. And he saved us. Now we have a fascinating account, which, as we read it, it's going to have one meaning, and the Gemara attributes I don't want to say completely different, but one we never would have thought of without the Gemara. Vayerdu shlosha mehashloshim rosh, and three of the top 30 came down. Now the question is, do we mean, or it either means three of the top 30 or means three of the great soldiers? As I said, that word shloshim either means 30, the number 30, or it means great soldiers, because the word shalish means great soldiers. So, three of the 30 came down. One could either understand it's the three we just mentioned, or, as we'll see, there's a second group of three, which we'll get to after this. We hear this story. Vayavo el katsir el David. They came to the harvest to David. El me'aras adulam, to the cave of Adulam. V'chayas plishtim chona be'emek refoyim. And here you have the beasts of the plishtim, meaning these wild beasts, the plishtim, they were encamped in emek refoyim. V'david oz ba'metzuda, David was then in the fortification. U'matzav plishtim oz beis lachem. And there was also an arm of the plishtim that had come out to beis lachem. So the plishtim are primarily in emek refaim, and then there's this group of plishtim that have also forayed out to beis lachem. Now this is a fascinating thing. Vayisaved David vayomar. David desired and he said, Mi ashgeni mayim mi bar beis lachem asher bashar. Who will give me water to drink from the well of Beis Lechem, that is in the gate. Vayivku shloshes hagiborim b'machaneh plishtim. So the three great warriors, they attacked, literally they cut down into the encampment of the plishtim. So they fought their way into the encampment of the plishtim, who were blocking the path to this well. Vayishavu mayim ibor beis lechem, and they drew water from the well of Beis Lechem. Asher bashar was in the gate. Vayisu, they carried it. Vayoviu al David, they brought it to David. David did not want to drink that water, even though he asked for it. And he poured it as a libation to Hashem. Vayomer nisen chalila li Hashem. It should be chas v'shalom to me Hashem. May associate us from doing this, meaning from drinking this water. Hadam ha'anashim ha'ochim b'nav shosam, the blood of the men going with their souls. V'lo avalishto, somebody didn't want to drink them. Eila asu shloshes hagibarim, this is what the three strong ones did. David did not want to drink the water. Why? Because they risked their lives for the water, and David felt that was unacceptable, that it was wrong to risk their lives for the water. And since
but since
they did that, therefore he did not drink it, and instead he poured it to Hashem. So again, who were the three? Either it's the three we just mentioned, or it's the three we're about to say. The three we're about to say are going to have some characters who we are more familiar with. Now, what is the story here with the water? First of all, why did he ask for it? Second of all, I mean, he needed water specifically from Beis Lechem, from the gate of Beis Lechem. It doesn't, they didn't have any other water. I mean, otherwise the whole army would have been very thirsty. They must have had some supply lines with water. So what was this with the water? So the Gemara says, this is the water here refers to Torah. Ein mayim ela Torah. Like we mentioned before, water refers to Torah. And David had a shaila. David had a significant question in battle. And he needed the answer to the question. And what he said is, he wasn't asking someone to actually do it. He said, who would get for me an answer to this question? He wasn't saying, someone please get me an answer to the question. He was lamenting the fact, we don't know the answer, and we need to discuss this with the Sanhedrin, which is what the shar almost always means. When you see the word shar, gate, it frequently refers to the Sanhedrin. It frequently refers to the gate of halacha, of Jewish law. And David was saying, would it be that I could get an answer to this question? And the three of these three great warriors of David took it upon themselves to hack their way through the Plishti lines that was between them and to get to the Sanhedrin, who were in Beis Lechem. And they got there, they were able to discuss the question with the Sanhedrin and come back. And David felt that was wrong, even though it was for a shiloh, it was for Torah. One does not risk their lives for Torah. We know that the Torah demands of us that we give up our lives for three mitzvos. That's avodah zarah, idolatry, gilui arayos, immorality, and murder. Those are the three we give up our lives for. But the Torah says, aside from those three, v'chai bahem, we have to live with the Torah, and therefore we do not give up our lives for other mitzvos of the Torah. And even though David needed an answer, it did not warrant risking their lives, despite the fact that they were great warriors, and perhaps it wasn't as great a risk for them as it was for anybody else, but nevertheless, it was three people fighting through the Plishti line, and it was wrong, and therefore David did not use the water, the answer that he got. Now,
is he punished for that?
Who? No, it seems that the Gemara says he was correct for this. So we have to understand what was the question that he needed to answer, and then how do you not use the answer? If it's Torah, it's Torah. How do you not use the answer that you got? Yeah.
Why don't we just take the simple meaning, which is that the Plishtim were occupying Beis Lechem. It says so right here. And the way to conquer Beis Lechem is, and it's no surprise that the well would be near the gate. In fact, we just saw a picture of that in one of the recent...
Okay, good.
And so when he says, who will bring me water, he's saying, who will go and attack these Plishtim for me in Beis Lechem? And they say, we will. And they go, and they engage at the gate, which is where the well happens to be, and they defeat them. And they come back and they bring the water, which was ostensibly like the Holy Grail of the expedition, but it was a way of saying, who's going to go out and defeat this garrison?
And then why didn't David use the water?
Because it was a victory of God. It was never about the water. It was about attacking the Plishtim. It was never about the water. It was about attacking the Plishtim. And when they come back with the water, he says, Baruch Hashem, and I dedicate this water to Hashem in honor of the great victory. It was never about the water.
See, and that to me is reminiscent of when he was fighting Goliath, and they said, who will fight Goliath? And he came out and said, I will. And then afterwards when, Shaul said, what do you want? I'll give you any. And he said, I'm okay. I don't need anything. It was the same
nice.
Thing.
I like it. It's a nice shot.
I mean, to me, it's just the good. Simple, plain
it could,
meaning.
It could,
you know?
Be, it could be that it is the simple meaning. It could be that it is the simple meaning. But the Gemara tells us that this is what happened. Now, it could be that what you're saying is also true. Could be.
I like it. I'm just imagining it out on the battlefield.
Good. As the simple meaning, I think it's very nice. Very good.
Normally, the Gemara doesn't give just one answer, though, to that. So is there a hint of what they just said in there?
No, this is all the Gemara says. No.
Normally they don't just come up with one answer. It's always with
depends.
Questions.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. This is the only thing the Gemara says on this. So, what question was being asked? It's a good answer.
It's like I'm watching a cowboy movie.
I like it.
The way you spell this out, it's like watching a movie. You know,
right.
And that's like saying. Who can I trust? Who will go out
think,
there for me?
I think it's very good. I think it's very good, but the Gemara doesn't say it. So
I think the Gemara doesn't say it because the pshat is so
obvious. It may be.
So the Gemara is reaching
right.
for some kind
right.
of...
You may be right. You might be right. That's why I like it. I think it's very good. Now, what question did David need answered? So the Gemara here has three possibilities. One is the in the course of the battle... They had to burn a field, which is not an uncommon tactic in battle. It's a way, first of all, of destroying the supplies of the enemy. It's also a way of destroying the hiding places of the enemy.
Which just happened, by the way, last year or so, you know, with all right. the tunnels and everything.
Okay.
They came up, it was like
Shemitah.
A miracle because of,
because
you
Shemitah.
Know that story, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Okay. So they needed to burn... They burned a field. Now, the field was Jewish-owned. So, in the process of burning the field, there were items that were... The field had standing grain. Here we have lentils. So, there was standing grain. I don't know what standing lentils look like. I don't know what it looks like. I don't know. But there's... Right? So in a field that's really full, you can have a bunch of things hidden in that field.
Mm, that's right.
So there is a discussion in the Gemara that in a case where there is a deliberate burning of something, somebody deliberately burns what belongs to somebody else, and in the process now has to pay him.
Mm-hmm.
Or even if it's an accident, but he has to pay for, you know, if a person causes someone else a loss of property by burning his things, he has to pay for it. But the Gemara says that there is... You're showing me what's standing...
That's a lentil plant.
Okay. All right, so good. So, I mean,
what did it say?
Okay, a lentil plant.
Okay, good.
Okay,
go
so the point is, if you have a bunch of these, you're going to... There's hiding. You know, you won't be... Good.
How tall do they grow?
The main thing is that they're not these little tiny...
This is how tall they grow. I mean, they're pretty close together.
Okay, right. That's
like
okay.
a bush. Almost.
Okay, so that's the point. Good, excellent. That's what we need to see. Right, so you see that if you have that... Then you can easily have things hidden in underneath them. So one opinion is that when he burned down this field, in the field he didn't realize that in the field there were items that the Jewish owner had in there, a plow, you know, I don't know, farm tools, things that were buried underneath this tall, thick growing plants, and they got burned as well. But David didn't realize they were there. When David burned the field, he thought he was only burning the lentil plants. So the Gemara has a machlokas, difference of opinion, whether someone is liable for items that were hidden. Mm-hmm. In a case of burning of property, so that we're not going to get into the technical discussion of whether or not a person is liable, but that was the question according to one opinion. That was David was asking. Second opinion is David was asking that in the course of battle, the plishtim, it was a plishti owned lentil field, not a Jewish owned lentil field. It was a plishti owned lentil field, and David needed to feed the animals of the Jewish army. And so, you know, that's the equivalent of needing to fuel the tanks, right? You needed to feed them. So there was a Jewish-owned farm nearby. He wanted to take the grain from the Jewish-owned farm, feed the animals, and then repay the farmer after they defeated the Plishtim with the Plishti-owned lentil field. Right.
Just to let you know, they only get 16 inches tall.
Okay. So it's not high enough to hide a plow, but you could certainly have.
Unless it was on the ground, plow was on the ground.
But you could certainly have all
a long
kinds
time
of.
Time ago, you know, and they could have.
Plants could have been different.
Right,
but okay, grapes were very big.
But the point is the thickness. That's the thing. You can have a lot of things here. Anyway, so that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to replace he wanted to deliberately take Jewish owned food crops, feed the animals, fuel the animals, and then. When he wins the battle, pay back. So the question was, is he allowed to deliberately do that? That was the question that he needed asked. And finally, what I think is the most fascinating of the three opinions of what the question was, is this, that the Plishtim were hiding in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, they were snipers.
Mm-hmm.
It was very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So the question was...
almost like they were mined, because the snipers could shoot far, but if they were lying with swords or daggers,
it would
be like encountering landmines.
Okay, something like that. Good. So now, could he burn down this field in order to save the Jewish people? Now, of course he could, because that's a life and death thing. See, until now, we're not dealing with a life and death question. Until now, we're dealing with a monetary question. He burned down the field, there were farm implements, and it hidden inside the field, does he have to pay for them? Okay, that's one question. Then the other one is a monetary question. Can I feed the animals and then pay back with the other thing? Here, it was life and death. Here, the question is, you've got these hidden Plishtim who are going to kill Jews, so... Are we allowed to burn down the field? Of course you could burn down the field. But the question is, if you do that, do you need to pay for it or not?
Mm-hmm.
And the way the Gemara words it is, are you allowed to matzil atzmo b'mamono shel chavero? Can I save myself with your property? So that means that I'm in danger for my life. So your item is here. Can I grab your item? To save myself, of course I can, because I can save my life. But does that absolve me from paying for it? That's the question that he had, which is a serious question.
But when you're king, you own it anyway.
That's the Gemara says. So the Gemara says the questions are good questions. Excellent. The Gemara says the questions are good questions. But a king, that was the answer. The answer they gave was that a king is allowed to literally break down a wall if he needs to go in that direction. The king has the right to do that. And therefore, David, you can do it. So the Gemara says, so then what does it mean he didn't use the water? He didn't rely on the permission that was given to him. Because since he held it was wrong for them to go and seek the answer, therefore he did not rely on the answer, even though it was the correct answer, that he was allowed to burn down the thing and not pay for it, but he paid for it anyway because he felt that it was wrong for them to have gone and gotten this answer.
All right, so we know that if you have a soldier who's very good at war, it's also because they're very good at Torah. And there were three of them. So they had their own Beis Din. Why wasn't that good enough to ask?
Good. So there's two answers. I was thinking about that. So there's two answers to that question. So one reason is because even if you've got the greatest warriors, in the midst of battle, it's hard to really think straight. Now that's, you know, you're in the thick of things. It's more difficult. Okay, but these people are still much bigger than we're talking about, so perhaps they were able to do that. But the other thing is that the Sanhedrin, you're talking about 70 people. 70 great Talmidei Chachamim debating the issue together, where no matter what, even when you have the great sages, when you have 70, you've got that the number brings a certain siyata d'shmaya, a certain help from heaven. You've got the group. There is advantage to that. By the very fact that David said, "I need to know the answer," means he couldn't figure it out. He didn't know. So that means he and the people who are with him really didn't know the answer. So they had to send the question, and that's why I went to the Sanhedrin. But this last question does find expression in halacha today. It can happen. It's all going to be life and death situation. So let's, God forbid, a person finds themselves bleeding profusely, and there's a article of clothing nearby, and they grab the article of clothing, and they tie a tourniquet to save themselves. Do they need to pay? It's not their clothing. Do they need to pay for the clothing or not? They used it to save their lives. It was permissible to do that. Do they owe money to the owner of the clothing? Now, the owner may say, you know, I'm so happy it saves you. That would be nice if the owner did that, but the owner doesn't have to do that. So if the owner is demanding to get paid back, it's their item that got ruined, does the person whose life was saved need to pay the owner of the clothing? Or do we say that because the Torah wants life, the Torah expects all of us to forfeit our possessions to save another Jew's life, whether we're there on the scene or we're not there on the scene? If we're not there, so what? If our car can be used to save a Jew's life, and it's going to get battered when the Jew runs away with our car, that we have to be willing to give up our car to save the Jew's life, and we don't get reimbursed for it. Or no, or it's our car, and therefore we do get reimbursed for it. It did a mitzvah, but we still get reimbursed. That's the debate. That's one of the possibilities that was the debate over here.
So let's say the shirt's there, okay, the guy's not. He takes the shirt and uses it. If he doesn't want money back, does he get a portion of the reward for saving the life? Or if he regrets it, even though it's after the fact, does he lose
that's a good question.
That scar?
I think either way, the owner of the shirt gets rewarded. It was his shirt that was in the right place at the right time.
Even though he didn't have a part in the decision.
Right. Either way, he's going to get some reward for it. The question only is going to be what level of reward. Obviously, the happier you are with the mitzvah, the greater reward you're going to get. But for sure, he's going to get something because it was his item that saved the person's life. Okay, so
can you be part of the Beis Din that makes the decision on your question?
On your own question?
Uh-huh.
So you can in most instances, not all instances, but in most instances you can. It depends on the type of situation. This one, they didn't have a vested, you know, this wasn't strong enough. Yes, the question is paying for, not paying for, but it's saying it just wasn't they would have been able to be intellectually. They would be able to be intellectually honest in this situation.
But I don't understand. There's no urgency here. So why couldn't they wait till the whole war was over and then say, "Do I need to pay back or not?"
Good.
Why now?
Yeah. Good.
Because it doesn't seem like it's urgent for paying back.
Yeah. That last question would seem like it could wait. Yeah. Yeah. And the question of burning the only one that really needed to be answered right then was whether to feed the animals with the.
Lentil.
Yeah, that was a good question. Yeah.
But the other ones
good question.
Could
good
have
point.
Waited.
Good point.
I don't understand.
Good. I don't either. Good question.
Okay.
Good.
I think, you know, to go back for a minute to what I think is the shot of the whole thing, saying that, I just want to add one more comment to that, which is that saying, asking to have the water brought back is the equivalent of saying, bring me back the head of the plishti.
Yeah.
Because they're going to defend the well to the last man. That's their prize item. And if none of the plishti really had recognizable heads, you know, how would they prove that they had vanquished them in battle? By bringing back water.
Okay, good. That would be the proof that they had defeated the plishti.
Is there a difference in level or when you should sacrifice an animal to be thankful or when you do a water libation?
Well, water libation really is supposed to be only in the Beis HaMikdash. So that's anyway
well, so
curious
are
over
any
here.
Sacrifices
that's
at
true
this
too.
Point.
Yeah, that's
so
true too.
That still doesn't help me clarify.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. There's no case of a voluntary water libation.
Except for this.
I don't know if I don't mean to say there's no other place in all of Tanakh. What I mean to say is that as far as sacrifices in the Beis HaMikdash are concerned, the only official nisuch hamayim water libation that we have is the ones done on Sukkot, and that's it. There are no other ones.
But Yaakov did oil on
yeah, he did oil.
So that's not like a water libation because it's oil?
Yeah, it's oil. We find wine. But water we only find on Sukkot and that's it. Well, carbonos, you know, animals.
So why would
find
he even think of doing a water libation here? I don't get it. Then.
Yeah, so he's taking the water. That's the thing. It depends which explanation you use. But according to the Gemara, he just didn't use, he dedicated that answer to Hashem. He said, I'm not going to use the answer. I'm going to pay for it because I don't want people to get the impression that it was a good thing that they did, that they broke through to get the answer. If you want to use Dr. Fari's explanation, so it would be that he poured it out because he said, I'm not going, it wasn't literally a libation like on the Mizbeach. It was saying, I'm pouring this out for the sake of Hashem. I don't want people to get the impression that what they did was correct.
Even though I asked him to do it.
In my shot, he's pouring it out because
he's saying, right, okay, he doesn't want people to think that
it wasn't about the thirst, it wasn't about the voice. Okay, thanks,
good.
Mission accomplished.
Good.
We're done.
Okay.
Since it wasn't such a time-crushing question, they didn't have to go rush in that moment. And
yeah, that would be a reason why it would have been wrong to go then. Yeah, that's true. Okay, now, Pasuk Yurches, by the way, this also, even though I do not like to talk about contemporary things like this, but this point about risking one's life to learn Torah might inform a decision about someone traveling to learn Torah. So now, Pasuk Yurches, verse 18. So the next group of three. Vavishai Achi Yoav ben Tseruya. So here we have somebody we've had before, always spoken of in the most glowing of terms. Avishai ben Tseruya. So Avishai, the brother of Yoav, the son of Tseruya, who rosh ha-shiloshah, he was the head of these three, the next three, not the three we mentioned before, but the three we're about to talk about, who Orer es Chaniso, and he awakened his sword, al shlosh meos chalal, on 300 corpses, v'lo shem bashlosha, and he had a name amongst the second three. Why do I say second three? Because of the next pasuk. Min ha-shlosha hachi nichbad, he was the most honored of the second three, v'yihi lahem lasar, he was for them as a leader, as an officer, but v'ad ha-shlosha lova, he did not come to the first three. The first three we listed, of Adino ha-etzani, and Elazar ben Dodi ben Achochi, and Shama ben Age Harari, he did not get to that level. He was on the level of the next three. This is Avishai ben Tseruya.
This is very confusing, right?
Yeah.
With all these shaloshas.
Yeah. I'm giving you one explanation of it. I mean, there are other ways of reading it, but this is what I felt was the most clear. Pasuk Chaf, verse 20. Uvna Yahu ben Yahu Yada. Here's our second of the second three. Bina Yahu ben Yahu Yada ben Ish Chai, the son of a living man. Rav Pa'alim, did many great deeds. Mikav Tse'el. Gathering of Hashem is literally what it means.
It says here a city, for what it's worth.
From Kavtzel. Yeah, that would be the simple meaning. That's true. Yeah. Okay, good. Because Gemara uses all these words to explain about Ben Yoyada. Huhika es Shnei Ariel Moav. He struck down the two, literally the lions of Moav. And he went down and he struck the lion inside the pit beyond Mashalag on the day of the snow in Israel. And he struck the Egyptian man. Now this story, I don't know why this I love this the most. He struck, of all the numbers, to me this is like the most impressive. He struck the Egyptian man.
Struck meaning killed?
Killed,
or?
Yeah, he killed. The Egyptian man. Ish Mare, a man of appearance, which means he was a man of stature. Uviana Mitzri Chanis, the Egyptian had a sword. Vayeri Nela Vashavet. And Binayo Ben Yoyada came down to him only with a stick. So he had a stick, the Egyptian had a sword, and the Egyptian was a man of stature. He swiped the sword from the hand of the Egyptian and killed him with his own sword. So you can just picture Binayo ben Yoyada coming in, and he's greatly not outnumbered, but out-weaponed. What's the right word for that? He doesn't have the proper weapon, and all the mitzvah has to do is hit him with the sword. And Binayo ben Yoyada manages to move quickly enough and to be sly enough and, you know, to make a fake or something like that, and is able to grab that sword right out of his hand and then kill him with his sword. This is Binayo ben Yoyada.
Well, he doesn't slice his hand.
Right. Binayo doesn't slice his hand. Right. Eile asa Binayo ben Yoyada. This is what Binayo ben Yoyada did. V'lo shem bishlosha giborim. He has a name in the three strong ones, meaning the second of the three. Min ha-shloshim nichbadi, was very honored amongst all the... Now here, shloshim means all of the soldiers. He was very honored. V'lo ha-shlosha lova, but he did not come to the first three. He was still in the second tier of three. Vayasimehu David al mishmato, and David put him on his
confident.
Right. And then finally, the third of the second three is the first one of the next pasuk. Asoel Achiyov Bashloshim. Asoel, the brother of Yoav, in amongst the soldiers. And I'm going to stop here for now, even though we're right in the middle of a pasuk, because this is going to list the rest of the warriors. Now, Asoel was killed early on, if you recall. He's the third brother. Remember, there were three brothers, of three sons of Tsruya, Yoav, Avishai, and Asoel. Asoel was killed by Avner all the way back in the beginning of Shmuel Beis, but he is the third of the second tier of three. Now, Binayo ben Yoyada, we still need to talk about. We're going to leave that for next time, Mirtz Hashem. But Binayo ben Yoyada here is listed as the second in the second tier of three, after Avishai ben Tsruya, and you see this great story of stealing the sword. But I've told you before that Binayo ben Yoyada was an up-and-coming soldier. Not a soldier, warrior. In the days of David, in the days of Shlomo, he becomes the warrior of Shlomo. He becomes Shlomo's right-hand man. He becomes the general of the army. Binayo ben Yoyada ends up leading the army for Shlomo under Shlomo's reign. So that's Binayo ben Yoyada. So we're going to see. The Gemara tells us on each of these words back in Pasuk Chaf, verse 20, when it goes through all of the description of Binayo ben Yoyada, the Gemara elaborates on these words. So what we need to do next time is explain more about Binayo ben Yoyada. In Malachim, whether we learn Malachim next or not, but in the beginning of Sefer Malachim, in the beginning of the Book of Kings, Binayo ben Yoyada plays a central role in establishing Shlomo's kingdom. Remember, Shlomo is only 12 years old when he takes over. Binayo ben Yoyada becomes the man who establishes Shlomo's throne and then maintains the throne for him after Shlomo takes the throne. So we have to know about Binayahu ben Yoyada, even though in this list he's number 5, but that's only now. When we get to Shlomo Melech's reign, he will be the top warrior.
Is there, as a final comment here, is there anything to be derived from the fact that there was this Egyptian among the Plishtim?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know the answer about that. Even Goliath was really a Moavi. He was really from Arpa.
He was.
Right?
Right.
Now maybe his father was a Plishti, but you know, so you do
that's
have
interesting, right?
Yeah.
He wasn't among the Plishti.
If his father was a Plishti, he would be a Plishti, but he descends from Arpa. We say his great strength came from Arpa, who was from Ar. So
thank you very much.
Thank you.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.